This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show entrepreneur and the woman behind the 343 Fund, Angela Skudin. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics. From her lifelong health battle she was able to reverse through holistic practices and psychedelic therapy, her marriage to Casey, an FDNY firefighter and lifeguard, the tragic accident that stole Casey from her and her children, overcoming grief, emotional healing, the power of psychedelics, Ibogaine, the life-saving initiatives of the 343 Fund, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Angela Skudin. Enjoy. Well, Angela, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to our mutual friend, Michael Buhman, for making this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you to the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks, James. I'm happy to be here.
So where are we finding you on planet Earth this afternoon?
So I am on Long Island in the great state of New York.
Beautiful. Well, I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey, and obviously we'll talk about Casey as well. So tell me when you were born. And tell me where you were born, and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I lived there for the first 23 years of my life. I have one sibling, Lisa, an older sister. She and I were very competitive and had the same hobbies, sometimes by force. So it was, you know, we took a lot of beatings from each other. And then we were in a household with my two parents, Ben and Gail. My mom immigrated from Germany, post-World War II Germany, which was formerly Poland. And I was first, well, I guess she was first generation, but I was first to be born on American soil from her lineage. My father is a mortgage banker. My mother was a stay-at-home mom and then worked in the health insurance field. So I went to Catholic school my whole life and dropped out of college and proved that you don't need pieces of paper to be successful. So yeah, I have a few businesses in Long Beach, New York. I've just pretty much always done what I wanted to do without hesitation or thought of consequence. And I don't really do a lot of research when I want to do something. I just figure out how do we get it done. So from that, I've got a really cool store, a couple stores in Long Beach, New York. Nothing online. You just have to be there to experience it. And one's an apothecary shop. One's like local artisan gift shop. And then I have a coffee shop. And then I run a foundation for first responders that helps them get help, grant access, and a supportive container for psychedelic journeys for the medical assistance or PTSD, a lot of addiction issues in that arena. So just to kind of like give them the help and support that they don't get when they're on the job for the traumas that they take on for us as regular humans on Earth. And that's about it. I'm a mom too. I've got two boys. One's 23 and he graduated from Cornell a couple of years ago. And then I've got a super bright 13-year-old about to be 14 and a bunch of rescue dogs.
I want to go all the way back, but just before we do, apothecary, educate me on exactly what would be within those four walls.
So my friends and I make a bunch of home remedies with plants, minimal ingredients, all organic, just like we're really super conscious about where we get all the products. And it's just from our ancestral knowledge, really, and then what I learned through my own healing journey. I had a really severe battle with Lyme disease, a bunch of tick-borne co-infections, and some environmental toxins. So, yeah, just all the tips and tricks that I learned from that. And then I do it with my best friend, Brittany Shutta, and then one of our other friends, Karen and Michelle. And, yeah, we just kind of base it on like old Nordic knowledge. And yeah, it's pretty cool to just use your own remedies instead of going, I haven't bought anything in a pharmacy in years. So
what are some of the most successful ancient remedies that you find in contrast to the chemical versions available today?
My favorite is definitely saffron. I think it's really telling that saffron's red also, and that they say like red dye causes ADHD symptoms. So I sometimes think that the plants mock us on their remedies. I think saffron's one of them. For me, it's been the most notable for my personal use. I was actually an Adderall addict for many years, and it was super easy for me with my ADHD to get Adderall. And that was in the way of my function and my healing. So yeah, I've been using saffron for a while. It's the only downfall. It's really expensive. But so is killing yourself with Adderall. So this isn't much. I don't drink anymore. So I think about, oh, I'm buying these bottles of saffron instead of, you know, expensive bottles of wine.
And are you taking it? Justification. Are you taking it neat, like as an actual dose, or are you using it in other products?
So I take it as a dose. I take it and make a tincture out of it. I was using an alcohol based extraction, just because you can extract more of the plant with an alcohol based extraction. But I just recently actually had an ibogaine journey, and with ibogaine, you continue making neuroibogaine for 30 days post-treatment, at least, we know scientifically, and that has a lot of positive function for longevity and whatnot. So I made a vegetable glycerin-based saffron tincture. It just costs a lot more. It's about $60 at cost for the bottle, and that's a lot. I use 1 milliliter a day, just usually when I'm getting ready to work and I need to just have an organized mind. And it for me, works beautifully.
Amazing. Yeah, there's so many areas where I'm sure that modern products are contributing to cancer. I think one of them, this is my own personal belief, is skin cancer and sun products. Because if I've always just gone back to what would we have done prior to a lot of this modern technology. And if you're saying that humans are so fragile that they can't be exposed to the sun at all, then we know that a lot of us were partially clothed or not clothed at all in our history. How do you explain that? And then your skin literally tells you I've had too much by going red. So if you're going to be out on a fishing boat all day, yeah, there's an application there maybe for some of the safer ones. If you're just going to go out and walk for an hour in New York in May, do you need to be covered in SPF 1000?
I haven't used sunscreen personally in years. I will use different supplements. Mainly lycopene is actually one of my favorites. Just eat more tomatoes in the summertime. But I feel the same way about sunscreen, and we always use non-toxic sunscreen, but further than that, chemical-free. People don't realize that there's a lot of natural options for that. And I think they're scared to use it because they think it won't work or it wasn't recommended. But yeah, I think it's really interesting that a lot of the preventatives seem to be the causatives for so many of our diseases.
Yeah.
We don't fall for the sunscreen trick in my house anymore.
Well, even if you look at a lot of the most effective medications, they're derived from plants. They're derived from pigs, insulin or all these things. They're originally just us copying something that naturally exists. They're the most effective ones.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't know any of that, though, until pretty recently. Probably 2018 was when I had my big wake up to, just the choices and the different things that might have been causing my body more harm than good. So you can't fault people for just, you don't know what you don't know. And I was definitely in that category. But now that I know, I just do a lot better. It's also what you eat. People don't understand that even like ingesting certain things will cause you to burn more. Seed oils. If you eat a lot of seed oils, they say you are what you eat, but you really are. So that's also going to cause you to burn faster. I remember though, growing up, do you remember this when you were always, the ozone layer was always getting a hole in it,
mm-hmm.
like every year, like that was a big thing, and then Y2K, that was always like, that was a big thing that was going to happen. So I feel like they sell a lot of products based, running a fear-based society about, if you don't put this on your skin, you're going to get cancer. And then there's also this thought that we have all this control over any medical issue that we get as a human. Like we really think we have it under control. And then part of that control issue is that then it's our fault, if we get sick, mm-hmm. because it has to be something we did, and it's not. Most of the time when you get sick, it's your body's just beautiful response to what it does naturally to make you a good human. And if you're the type of human that doesn't get sick, you probably got sick a lot at one point in your life, to build up a really good system. So whenever I get sick, if I do, I don't get sick very often at all. But if I do, I know it's my body's just call to rest. So I try to take a hint on that and do what I can do to support it while it gets what it needs. It knows more than we know, and we forget how smart our body is. So, because we think we're the smartest.
I think there's a lot of arrogance in medicine. I think I don't think it's the people that were creating it, the people that were really trying to reduce suffering. It's the people that realize you can make money from it. But when you look at the human body and you listen to these people that, for example, have gone on a plant-based diet, that doesn't have to be long-term, but to reverse disease at least, the body wants to be in homeostasis. And if you look at your stress levels and your sleep and your ingestion, your diet, your hydration, all these things that you can control that, again, circling back to ancient man, what we would have done, you know, walk and drink from a stream and all those things. It's amazing the healing ability of the body, but that is what's completely rebuked by medicine. Like, oh, you can't reverse, you know, heart disease. You can't reverse diabetes. Like, you can. Absolutely. Now, if you've lost two legs by this point, yeah, you might be a little bit too far gone, but you listen to the people that are doing it. There's people all over the world that are using food, you know, and these kind of cleanses to completely reverse disease. And obviously we're going to talk about that today.
Well, you can't grow your legs back, but you can still reverse diabetes. You know, I think that's like, that's one thing too, is that mindset though, when people, you will do whatever you say you're going to do. If you say, I'm not going to heal, you are not going to heal. And there was actually a part in my healing journey. I think a lot of people go through this, where I knew that I could consciously make a decision to stay stuck in my suffering and nobody would blame me. You know, they would just be like, oh, poor woman, whatever. And they would buy and the story that I was selling, and I could go down the road and stay stuck in my suffering. And then I started noticing people that do that as soon as I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. And me then just getting so triggered by the people that were doing that. And then obviously saying to myself, I don't want to be one of those people. So I was told I couldn't get rid of anything that I had, and that I would be on daily antibiotics to even attempt getting rid of it, and antiparasitics for 5 to 9 years. And that was just unacceptable to me. And I thought, well, it took you so long to even tell me what was wrong with me. How do you know anything? And I actually was listening to, I was watching Joe Dispenza on the Heal documentary. And he was talking about his meditation practice that he did to heal his back. And he had this horrific back injury, and he used meditation and the power of his mind to put his back together. And I thought, this man is just a man, just like me. And if he can do that, so can I. So that was the day I started my meditation practice. I ordered a book that said how to meditate, and it's not how you meditate at all. And I remember sitting in my infrared sauna, just full of disease and toxins, and just really trying to sweat it out and do something positive for my body, and reading this book, How to Meditate, and being the most frustrated I've ever been in my life. And now when I go to meditate, it is a practice. And after practicing it for so long, I can meditate in 2 seconds, just like really just drop in. And it doesn't matter about the noise around me or anything. But I learned, if I didn't put myself through those super frustrating situations where I'm telling myself how much I hate something and how difficult it is, and the task that I'm trying to master isn't even worth it. So for me, meditation's been a huge part of getting out of my mind so that my body can heal. And it's something that I implement almost on a daily practice. That and my Duolingo. That's it.
My wife does that religiously too.
I can't lose my streak. I'm almost to 600 days.
That little where the brain comes out of their head when they're amazed how perfect you were.
I need that validation in my life.
Well, I want to go to early life again, and then we'll walk through and we'll obviously kind of unpack some of these illnesses that you're talking about. But just so I don't forget it later in the conversation, as a paramedic on the EMS side, you see a lot of times where someone's illness or diagnosis starts to become their identity. Was there that element of you? And then was that ever a barrier to maybe taking that step into the healing side?
No, I grew up in a family that gaslit me that then nothing was ever wrong with me. So I think I finished a soccer. I finished a soccer game with a broken leg, and then I got taken to the hospital. I also think I had to go home and clean my room to get the ride to the hospital to get the cast. So no, I came from just really thinking that everything was fixable from a Western medicine perspective, that I could go to the doctor, they would write me a prescription, and 30 days later, you know, everything was in check. And I came from a childhood of treating the symptom and not the root cause. So I actually think what happened to me began when I was 11 years old. And that's when I started having, I started these weird food sensitivities, you know, out of nowhere. So now when I'm, you know, you don't know what you don't know, but now I know a tremendous amount about the, at least the diseases that I had. And I think that a lot of it started back then and I just didn't know. And I think that that was so easily translated to orthopedic conditions for the activity level that I had as a youth. I was extremely active in sports and just kind of did that 24/7. So having arthritic issues at 14 years old, having something that they describe as Montauk knee with Lyme disease was really easy to write off with four surgeries, you know, just go in there, scope it out, send me on my way. So I think I got Lyme disease when I was 11 years old and I have a really strong immune system. And I also had a lot of toxic behaviors. And eventually when I was in my late 30s, my immune system went over the waterfall. And yeah, I ended up bedridden, covered in sores from head to toe. And I had a decision to make if I wanted to climb out of this or if I wanted to take on the identity of a sick human being for the rest of my life. And I, no part of me would ever take on the identity of a sick human being. So I figured out a way out.
When you reflect back now with this lens that you have in 2025, and obviously the plant medicine has healing abilities physically, but also obviously we'll talk about emotionally and mentally as well. Were there any elements of your upbringing that affected you emotionally that could have contributed to the breakdown of the nervous system or the immune system, excuse me?
Oh, for sure. Like I thought there was no God because I came from this thought of the only way through like the validation for me on if I'm doing a good job in life is if God is favoring me. So I was, you know, viewing myself as unfavored when I was, you know, covered in sores and like having and losing teeth and, you know, having to have my breast implants removed and losing the ability to wear makeup, losing the ability to eat food that I wanted to eat. And I really put myself in a victim mindset. But I didn't do that for very long, thankfully. I feel like it was really necessary for me to go through all these stages too of this mindset. Because then when I'm talking to somebody else who's still at that stage, I really can relate with that stage and either help coax them along or, you know, just honor that they're there, you know, and that's what they're choosing. And that's fine. You know, there's no right and wrong on this, but, you know, they'll have to find new people to talk to about it. But yeah, it's just, it was one of those things for me that I spent a little bit of time just like, there is no God. Why would God do this? Mad at God, you know, whatever that means. Until I just knew that I was having to figure this out so that I could tell other people how to do it. And so I just had this turning point where I was just really accepting of this mission. I also had a partner at home that was so supportive and I was kind of the glue in the family. So I was always a person just my whole life that, oh, I'll get it figured out. Like even if I was 5 years old, I'm pretty sure if something really went down, my family would come to me and be like, okay, what do you think? I hope so, because children at least till the age of 5 are geniuses. So we should always be asking them what they think. But yeah, I was that person. So he just gave me this order of, okay, I need you back and I will do whatever you say for you to accomplish that. And I told him, okay, it's going to get really weird, you know, what I found that I'm going to need to try to do. And he said, you know, that's fine. And he supported everything that I tried, everything that I wanted to try. Part of it, the help of it was that I had researched it so deeply. I pretty much turned a full-time job into just researching the diseases that I had. And then kind of ancient Ayurvedic ways to treat these modern diseases. Yeah, I just found that energy work became super helpful to me. And in the beginning, when I started this practice, I didn't believe in any of it. I I thought this is silly. This is a waste of money. Acupuncture is a waste of time. And now, yeah, I do acupuncture on a regular basis, chiropractic weekly, my child the same. And I lay on a Beamer mat once a day and inject myself with NAD plus and just, yeah, try to support my system as it's aging as best I can. And whatever I'm doing has worked so far for me. I haven't had a sick visit to a doctor in over 5 years, and nor has my youngest son. So
amazing. Well, let's kind of go back to as you're progressing through, you know, college and beyond. What were you dreaming of becoming as far as career-wise? And then where did you find yourself on that journey as far as the choice of professions initially?
Oh my God. What was I dreaming career-wise? I was dreaming of like, how could I make money without working? Yeah, that's actually what I was doing. So I pretty much put all my efforts towards like, definitely just, I knew I didn't want to work for anybody else for sure. I went through like 7 different majors before I dropped out of college. And then I'm probably the worst person for any parent to have talked to their kids about their future, but because I'll tell them to just do whatever they want to do and then make money along the way. And if there's nothing that is there where they can make money with what they do, just make something that does that. So I pretty much just always did that. I knew I wanted to open a store eventually. Somebody else that I knew opened a store, and I just thought, well, if they could do that, I can. I didn't look up what it took to do it. I just did it. But to open my first store, I garbage picked all the wood out of the bay. I would climb in the water and garbage pick shelves from the wood and dry them out. And we did the floor ourselves, my husband and I and a friend. And I was married to a New York City firefighter, so you could always find somebody to come help you paint. So yeah, we just did it all ourselves. And that's how I started my first store. And it's always just been successful. I have a new location now, a bigger store, and then a store inside that store. So, yeah, I just also just kind of look for what my community needs. I live in Long Beach, New York, and I want my town to have everything that I want my town to have. So if there's something that my town doesn't have, my town didn't have an apothecary, and I would go to Costa Rica every year. We would go there and for years. And there was this apothecary place, and anytime I got sick at all in Costa Rica, I would just go in there and tell the lady what was wrong with me, and she would give me what I needed, and it would get taken care of. And I thought, well, why don't we have that, you know, in Long Beach, New York? I can get Amazon in 2 hours, which is part of the reason why I stay where I stay. But I can't go get a natural plant remedy, so we fix that, and I put that in my town. Same thing with I couldn't get, you know, a good cup of coffee in my town, you know, or like a quality matcha or cacao. And I wanted those things throughout the day. And I wanted to be able to have that in my community. Even everyday dose mushroom coffee, I want to have that whenever I want it. And I don't want to make it myself. So I made a coffee shop and we opened that. I have no idea what I'm doing ever. And I have absolutely no qualification to do anything that I do on a piece of paper, but for some reason I have the magic stick when it comes to being successful in business and doing what I want to do. So yeah, I just keep doing that. And I don't have any idea like what I want to be when I grow up. I don't know. When my son told me he was picking a major in college, I tried to talk him out of it. And I was right. He ended up not going. He thought he was going to be pre-med. So he got stuck in a bio major. I probably told him to do hotel restaurant because why not? And then he came to me right before his junior year and said, oh, I can't change my major. I'm stuck in this bio major. And I said, that sounds like hell. You put yourself there. So you'll finish. And he did. But, you know, it could have been more fun.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned about Casey being FDNY. Was he a firefighter when you met?
No, he was a lifeguard and just a construction worker. You know, and I shouldn't say just a construction worker. No, he was a lifeguard and a construction worker, and I liked both of those things, you know, enough to get married. And he actually became a firefighter because his childhood best friend's father, Randy and Eric Eichen, are the two best friends, and their father is Donald Eichen. And he was just like a really cool dude that fished all the time and like lived this really cool life. And he was a New York City firefighter, and he had a nickname, Gums, from a surf spot in Hawaii that he nicknamed by losing his front teeth by taking a wipe out there. So the boys just thought he was just the coolest of cool. So he made that man, Donald Gums Eichen, made probably 6 or 7 New York City firefighters out of that friend group. And my husband was one of them.
This is what's interesting. My generation, you know, even though I wasn't actually from a firefighter family, you know, they say a lot, the best recruitment tool is the firefighter themselves, you know, and when everything is good and there's a good environment and you're supported well, we're shouting from the rooftops about how good it is. But it's sad because as we've seen that deteriorate, it's been the opposite. Fathers aren't telling their sons and daughters to be firefighters as much, the same in the military. So I truly believe that we can turn it around and go back to that again, because the profession hasn't changed. It's a calling. It's beautiful. But you've also got to give that environment where these men and women can go home to their families and not be forced to stay, you know, longer because of understaffing and mismanagement.
You know, if you're happy, I think one of the reasons why my marriage was so successful was because I always did what I wanted to do. And so I was always happy. And my husband had the greatest job in the world, if you asked him, as a New York City firefighter. And, you know, the guys individual to the firehouse make that the greatest job in the world, like that internal family. And that's what's so unique about being a firefighter. And that's actually what I employed with my organization to help firefighters, was that like kind of like the kitchen table attitude, not only for like normalization, but, you know, for the hard talks. So we have that internal support system with a 343 fund. And yeah, the New York City Fire Department was a huge influence for the creation of that.
Beautiful. Well, you were with Casey before he became a firefighter. So what was your kind of observation of the changes and differences between pre-fire service and then when he was in the job?
Oh, I got to like watch whatever I wanted to on TV when he spent the night at the firehouse. yeah, I loved being, I don't even know what the differences were before. Life was really hard. I remember when he went, when he was a probie, they don't get paid a lot of money. And then you have to finagle life or like live with your mom and dad. They just make it super hard for you. And then you have to live, you know, in a certain area, and it's super expensive in New York. So just a lot of suffering in the beginning, and a lot of really long hours and a lot of sacrifice, you know, not home on holidays. You know, when you're the junior guy, you're there's just a lot of giving up. That said, I absolutely loved being a firefighter wife to the point where I don't think I could ever live with somebody full time. I think that would be just like, so a lot of the guys talk about, oh, the retirement factor and that being something. So I always think about, you know, what would have happened when my marriage had been so good post-retirement, but we had a pretty good streak going. But now it is something that I think about all the time. I love my alone time, and you have a different relationship with your kids. And for me, my kids, actually just this morning, my youngest was talking about the difference in me and who I was before my husband died and the person that I am now. And, you know, I've done a lot of mourning myself of that person. So when it comes up for my kids, I let them do that too, you know, just like talk about her, because I do think it helps them process forward and also accept the role that I was forced into. So
Which area of New York was Casey working in, and what kind of company was he in?
Casey was in Ladder 137, Engine 268, Rockaway Beach, New York. He was also in the Surf Rescue Company, and then he was in the mentor-mentee program. His favorite thing about being a New York City firefighter, I think, besides putting out fires, was definitely being on the Surf Rescue Company. So, yeah, he rode his bike to work every day. It was 12 miles door to door. A lot of boardwalk riding to, from Long Beach, New York, straight to Rockaway Beach. So we had just a really good life. He had a great life, and he loved his job so much. He loved being a New York City firefighter. He loved being an ocean lifeguard. So yeah, he saved a lot of lives when he was here.
What are some of the notable rescues you remember when he was working?
Oh, just being married to him over the years, there's a lot of water rescues. We'd just be on vacation. One time we were in Cancun and we're sitting on the beach and I don't know what's going on. And he's sits up and he's just looking pretty hard, and he takes his sunglasses off and he puts them on the towel. And I'm like, what are you doing? He puts his cell phone down and he's like, oh, this guy's drowning. And I'm like, where? And he's like, right out here. Do you see him? I'm like, he doesn't look like he's drowning. He's like, he is drowning. And I'm like, are you going to go get him? And he said, not yet. You have to let him marinate a little bit so that they're happy to see you. So, and then he just got up and ran in and then pulls this guy out. And the whole family's like, oh my God. And Casey's just so nonchalant. And then another one was, these are just not even on the job rescues. He also had two medals from the FDNY, but my most notable ones weren't during a fire because I didn't work with them. But he came in the room a few weeks before he died, actually, and he was just covered in blood. And I was on the phone with our oldest son. I said, what are you doing? What's going on and whose blood is that? And he's just super panicked. And he's like, where were you? And I said, I'm on the phone. And he goes, I have been screaming your name and I needed you. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, I just gave Steve mouth to mouth. This is his blood. And Steve was our neighbor and he'd fallen down the stairs and he was a bigger man. And Casey said, I needed you to carry Steve down the stairs. And Steve is way too big for my one rep max deadlift. So I was like, Casey, I definitely couldn't carry Steve. And he was like, yes, you could. And he was just so delusional about any of my abilities. But yeah, he gave Steve mouth to mouth until the paramedics came, and he saved Steve's life. And Steve's wife put a sweet card, you know, in our mailbox, just thanking Casey. And, you know, that was just a few weeks before he died. So stuff like that happened on the regular with Casey. He was just that person. And he was so chill, like right after he did it, like Superman style. So it was fun to be married to him.
You mentioned one rep max deadlift. I know he was a CrossFit athlete as well. Talk to me about how that served him as far as lifeguarding and fire.
I mean, I don't know if he was like, I mean, he did do CrossFit at one point in his life, but I don't know if he was like just an engine workout guy. Like he loved hero workouts and he was a CrossFit coach. He coached at his local gym and I had a text message from him like the week before he died that, hey, I'm not coming home after work. I'm going to the gym and I'm meeting one of the guys from work there. He always was recruiting new people to his CrossFit cult. So, it was a big part of our relationship at one point too. We did a lot of partner workouts and competitions and we both like to win, and I worked harder for him than any other human on the planet. So yeah, it was fun to win with him and to compete with him and try to keep up with him. So the guys would all come back for college. His favorite thing to do, he'd come home and he'd be like, yeah, the 20 somethings just can't even catch me today. They're just trying to keep up with me on the board. And yeah, he needed that. And he had it. So it was fun to to see that part of him too, is always making people work harder. And when he was a coach, he was super stoic, but you knew he was hypercritical too. So if he gave you a compliment, you know, he meant it. And you were always working. Every person in the room, when Casey was coaching, was working for a side, you know, a look from him, a compliment, an attaboy from him. Because when you got one, you knew he meant it, and you knew you were doing a good job.
Brilliant. Right. Well, let's go back to 11-year-old you. You mentioned that back then there was the beginning signs of this illness, and then walk me through all the way through to 2018 as far as the downward spiral.
Yeah. So I had just started getting like these weird allergy symptoms, and then like just being allergic to everything. And then I remember having to go get allergy tests, but I was eating a croissant roll that had like Velveeta cheese in it. I remember, you know, those like those crescent rolls that come in the tube. Mm-hmm. So I had made those for myself in the toaster oven. I just remember this like life event, scarring life event. And I got the worst stomach ache I've ever gotten in my life after eating that. And I went to the doctor and they told me I was lactose intolerant that day and that I couldn't have dairy anymore. And yeah, I go back to that moment a lot in my head without taking these pills. So I take these pills to eat this. And then I started allergy injections. I started orthopedic surgeries at 14. I had a bunch of those. And I suspect my orthopedic issues and my sudden lactose intolerance came from Lyme disease back then. I'd been bit by a tick so many times. When I was young, I grew up in Oklahoma and we were outside all the time. So we would just take like burn ticks off each other or pull them off and throw them. You know, if I got bit by a tick today, I would put it in a bag. I would send the tick off to a lab to have it analyzed so that I would know exactly what likely transferred into me. People don't understand that ticks carry over 200 diseases, and they think that they have to be on you for an amount of time, or, you know, there has to be some sort of rash that comes up. And no, I kind of look at these people and just be like, well, you get an STD, you know, if it goes in for any amount of time. So it's not like, oh, they didn't have it in for an hour, you're safe. No. Like they had it in, the tick bit you, there was a transfer. And please don't be naive, especially if you're talking to an uneducated doctor, which oftentimes people are. I rarely hear a doctor do the right thing or say the right thing when somebody is bit by a tick. And in 2025, that's terrifying. But Lyme disease creates a plethora of other diseases or non-diseases that they call diseases. And people get trapped on very harsh treatments that are very expensive and very hard on the body for a very long time. And they will never dig out of that issue. And they're going to think it's something else forever. And I was told I had fibromyalgia and that I needed orthopedic surgery for my back and my hip, reconstructive surgery that would have ended any of my athletic days at 39 years old. I said no to those surgeries for the first time in my life. If it had been up to my parents were the type of people that just like trusted the doctor. Why not? You do what the doctor says. And I'm not a person that trusts the doctor at all. You also have to understand that a lot of doctors could have been D students out there. So just because they have a piece of paper, you know, doesn't mean they know what's wrong with you or that they should be advising you at all. So yeah, I did a whole turnaround though for myself that involved like people say, what did you do to heal from Lyme disease? And now I eat cheese all the time, by the way. I'm not lactose intolerant. That was a lie. So I eat whatever I want, whenever I want. And I don't have any issues. But that took a incredibly long time to re-regulate my entire system from the ground up with what you mentioned, from diet to the water that I was ingesting. I didn't know anything about water and keeping my body alkaline. If somebody told me I had cancer today, I would do three things. I would test my water to make sure it was hydrogenated and alkaline. And I would get access to an HBOT, and I would order bees to begin bee venom immediately. And there's absolutely no way they would ever put chemotherapy in my body.
Yeah, I've said the same thing, simply because when I look at especially chemo, the concept basically, I know it's getting better now in immunotherapy, they're starting to be more precise. But the old chemo, it was like, all right, we're just going to control or delete the whole body, and fingers crossed the good stuff comes back. And it just doesn't, as someone who was in medicine, it makes no sense whatsoever. So,
you know what does do that though? Bee venom.
Oh, really? So educate me more on that, because I've never heard that mentioned as far as cancer before.
So it control alt deletes everything, and then it does rebuild healthy cells. So it's been used since the ancient Egyptian times. We know that. And yeah, they've never been able to replicate it. There's something about being stung by a bee, and for about the next 15 minutes after, the stinger actually pumps the application of the venom into your body. And that is a bee sacrifice to us. And I just don't think that our creator did that for no reason. So yeah, it's been shown in scientific studies to kill breast cancer cells for sure. And I used it wholly, head to toe, to rebuild my entire system. Did it for about 15 months. And a lot of the scientists that trained me on it had used it for rheumatoid arthritis himself. And he told me something so interesting. I said, oh, did the people that you helped, they call you and be like, oh my God, you saved my life and blah, 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 blah. And he said, no, I don't ever really hear from him. And he told me that people forget what saved them. And I thought that was super interesting. So
interesting indeed. Yeah. So you've got the bee venom. You're looking at obviously the alkalinity of the water. What were you changing as far as nutrition, your diet?
Everything. I went to an Ayurvedic diet. I figured out what my dosha was. If people listening don't know what their dosha is, that's okay. They can go online for like a free dosha test, and it just kind of tells you your body type. So, but more than that, I was able to switch seasonally to other things when I needed different things. Like when I needed more grounding, I would eat potatoes. It's pretty easy. When you start thinking about it, it's a diet based on the elements, and then eating based on, you know, your elements. So, I kept my body completely alkaline. A lot of kitchery was eaten. I had no idea what that was before, but I got to learn about it, and turmeric and cumin and all these spices that aren't traditionally in a Western diet that I implement into my diet daily now. So,
how did that lead you to the world of psychedelics?
Oh, yoga, right? Isn't that the gateway drug? I couldn't do CrossFit. I had a PICC line in my arm, and I needed to start working out again because I knew, and that's one thing about chronic disease, like you sweating is a huge part of your detox, huge part of detox pathways. So if I couldn't work out, I would sit in an infrared sauna. And if I could work out, I would do yoga. So I hate yoga so much, like to this day, but I do yoga. Because I need it. And just like the fascia release from it helped me so much. And within the walls of the yoga studio, I found my teacher who taught me about Ayurvedic and helped me with recipes and educated me on that, you know, before there was ChatGPT. And yeah, it really got me disciplined and a disciplined mindset, and introduced me to a practitioner who served combo. That's also been shown to kill cancer. That's probably actually the four things I would do. I would do HBOT, bee stings, combo, and a diet change with the water, alkaline water. But Combo does the same things on scientific studies, killing cancer cells. It's jungle medicine. It is legal in the United States. It's not any fun. It has nothing to do with psychedelics. But the practitioner that taught me how to serve myself Combo introduced me to a compound called iboga. That's a plant. And it comes from Gabon, Africa, from the Bawiti tribe. And we're working really hard in the United States right now on a state-by-state basis to get it medical access to this compound. It has been put on the stage one controlled substance list, schedule A controlled substance list. and it's wrongfully there. It is not an addictive substance, and it has scientifically been proven to regenerate white matter in the brain. And it's been a huge part of my healing. I did a very dangerous living room iboga journey when I was bedridden with Lyme disease and Babesia and Bartonella and relapsing fever, Borrelia and mold toxicity and Morgellons disease and heavy metal poisoning. But after 12 hours of living room iboga with some dude from California that's no longer on this planet, I fell asleep for the first time in my life without any thoughts, racing thoughts, without thinking of plan A, B, C, D, what I have to do tomorrow, the day after that, the day after that. And I slept like a baby for 8 hours, and I knew that it was because of that substance. I haven't taken a Xanax since. I've been free from an Adderall addiction. I've been free from a toxic relationship with alcohol, and I have not been sick since that living room iboga journey.
Now, have you just done one and done, or have you done it other times since?
So, no, I haven't been one and done, and I don't, to me, this isn't a one and done game. I say this is a, you know, you ever paid to get your car detailed? Super expensive, and you got to give your car up for a while, and they got to take all the seats out, and then you're super careful when you get your car back. But like, you need to either go get your car detailed again eventually. If you don't get a new car, we're not getting a new car, and or get your rags out and learn how to clean your car at home, you know, with different things. So I don't know how long you can do that. I can't clean my car at home for very long before I need to go back and get it detailed. So I guess it's just however you take care of your car. I've had a few journeys. I just went back actually last week for some cognitive stuff, leftover cognitive issues from I've been dealing with since Lyme disease. I had like pretty severe neurological dysfunction with it. I lost the ability to speak and say words. And I would be driving to my son's school or to my business, and I would pass it, and I would say, I have no idea where I'm going. And for a long time, I thought, oh my God, I have early onset dementia, until somebody told me that dementia is like you have your keys in your hand and you don't know you have a car. You know, and so that made me feel so much better. But I definitely was having major cognitive dysfunction and short-term memory loss that I have been working on. I had gone for medicine. I go to Ambio Life Sciences in Tijuana, Mexico for Ibogaine therapy. I think that they're the safest, and I trust them with my life and anyone else's. But yeah, it's like I now do it probably once a year. I don't know how long I'll keep that trend up, because it's a really difficult medicine to journey with, and you can't guarantee what's going to happen to you, and you can't guarantee like how long the suffering is going to be the day after. I'm a person that seems to get off fairly easily without suffering on what is traditionally known as the gray day. But I still am in a human body that likes to have a lot of control, and you can't control the out, like what happens when you get on the roller coaster there. So yeah, there's a bit of fear that always comes to the forefront when I'm about to journey with Ibogaine. But it's broken me free of so many addictive patterns. And when I talk to people that were former addicts and they seem to like have things under control, they say to me, well, like, why would I go do a drug to, if I already have this under control? And my response to that is like, if you have it under control because you're having to restrain yourself, you know, that's like tying a leash around a dog that's not trained and being like, well, this is under control. You know, I would rather go tame the beast personally and like absolve myself of that pattern. And psychedelics are the only way that we have found that we can successfully re-pattern our brain for positivity. So the fact that like I can now, like I could go have a alcoholic beverage with my oldest son, you know, to celebrate his birthday. That was the last time I probably had one. And I can have one and I don't need to have any more than that. And I also tell myself and anybody else who drinks an alcoholic beverage and says anything but that is just lying to themselves. But I tell myself the truth. And I say, I'm poisoning my body right now with this decision, but my body is this incredible machine that can support me and detox this out. And I take the proper protocol, post that to aid in my detox, like glutathione before I go to bed, even if I just have one. But yeah, it's maybe a once or twice a year thing. And it was my tool to get through life prior to me being able to break that pattern with Ibogaine.
It seems from the addiction point of view, I've had so many Navy SEALs on here talking about that. Marcus Capone obviously created Vets after his experience. But it seems like it just resets receptors. So whether it's sugar or caffeine or alcohol or whatever the thing is, when your body is said, oh, I like, you know, level 10 of this substance, then you're going to crave level 10. But if it's completely wiping it clean, it seems like the craving is gone. And maybe, as you said, the accumulation of stress and life issues start to push that up to one and two, and some people seem to need to do another one. But then I've had other people that have done the ayahuasca side and Ibogaine, and now they're starting to understand, well, as you said, with the rag at home, how can I get really good at detailing my car so I don't need to keep going back? So there's one called the Wisdom Dojo, one of my friends goes to. And so that's what's really interesting now, is that we realize this is working, but then, all right, now what's that post session looking like physically, you know, emotionally, mentally? How can we keep kind of re-upping on this so you don't have to keep going through journey after journey after journey?
Yeah, so there's that integration part. I'm familiar with the Wisdom Dojo. Isn't that Moose?
Is he that sounds familiar? Yeah, Kagan Gill was the friend of mine that had gone through it, and I forget the name of the person that founded it, but it may well be.
Okay. Yeah, I hear great things about that. So yeah, supportive container. It's also, okay, for somebody like a first responder, let's talk about that. I'm not a first responder, but I have had more than two trauma incidents in my life. So I'm an above average trauma human. And you know, what can those look like? Well, just ask any traumatized human, they can probably tell you what they went through. First responders go through, you know, 4,000 traumatic events. You know, their job full time is to respond to trauma, to our trauma. So all of that gets compartmentalized. So I feel like I just recently had a first responder, and he went through three Ibogaine journeys and two ayahuasca journeys. You know, so there's so many journeys this guy goes on. And why did he keep going through all of these journeys, and did it work? Okay. He kept going through all of these journeys because the reason why you're going on these journeys is to discover self-love. So he had discovered self-love, but then he absolutely couldn't implement it for himself. So he remained suicidal. He remained with suicidal ideations, and he remained not wanting to be here. And he remained in his story of suffering that anybody he told would have said, oh my God, this is what you've been through, you poor guy, you know? But I knew that he was going to break free. I knew that like there would be a psychedelic journey that would be the tipping point for him. which is why I supported him wholly, like through his entire journey, and gave him a container of support that he still utilizes. And I was privileged to be with him at the moment that he released his story. So do you have to use psychedelics to release your story? No. You can use something like the Landmark Forum, you know? Maybe you want to go sit in a chair and get mentally beat up for 36 hours. But you need to do something that is going to beat you down mentally so that you can say, this pattern that I love and I'm so familiar with and I'm so comfortable with, that is not good for me and it is not serving me, needs to change. And the only way to do that is to rewire your thought patterns. The quickest way to do that is psychedelics. The other super fast way to do that is breath work. For some people, psychedelics are easier to do than commit themselves to a meditation and breath work practice. For me, I like to get my rag out in between journeys and my hose, and I have a pretty intense self-care ritual pattern that I do every week that has breath work, meditation, chiropractic care, acupuncture, cupping, working out, and infrared saunas. So that's what I do so that I don't have to go through the car wash too often. But that said, I'm not afraid to drop my car off and get detailed either. So
what about on the physical side? You know, what did you start seeing as far as the resolution of symptoms that you had for so long?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I have to say this. What I had is controversial, but I had a piriformis nerve impingement. Apparently that's a controversial diagnosis, but as a person that lived in nerve pain for months, I can tell you the pain wasn't controversial. It was happening and it was very real. So I had left side scoliosis, spinal stenosis, degenerative disc disease, a piriformis nerve impingement. And I was told that I needed, and two fully bulged herniated discs, my L5-S1 and whatever the one is above it. So I declined surgery, and I also had a right side labral tear that I got gaslit about, that a doctor told me I didn't have, but then I did. But apparently I could move my body into a position that I shouldn't be able to with the labral tear. And that's how he came to that diagnosis. But I later had an MRI that showed it. And I am completely out of pain from all of said things, and haven't taken, I think I've taken like two ibuprofen in the last 3 years. So I don't have any issues. I also have I'm a science experiment and I do peptides. So that's how I've been avoiding all my arthritic symptoms, is actually just BPC-157. So it's kind of a little magic.
I swear by them. I use Transcend. And I had a few because I was wanting to boost my natural testosterone, not TRT, but the ones that boost your own. And I actually came off all of them. I was kind of a science experiment as well. It put me way too high up because my natural T was actually pretty good for a firefighter. But then I tapered off and I've come off completely, which is great as well, because now people that need a little boost, unlike TRT, where you're going to have to take it forever, with the peptides, you can take them and then come off. And the only...
What are you using for that? What peptide did you use?
That was, the one that I was left with, the main one was a clomiphene.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it worked really well, but I just didn't... I needed it just to get me up to kind of counter the damage of 14 years in the fire service doing shift work. But once it got up there, I'm like, well, let me come on. My whole thing is that we ultimately should not have to take anything when we get back to where we need to be. So you can't do that without an exit strategy. And so, yeah, it's been about 3 months off it and I've still retained the same body weight and strength. And, you know, still like you said, work in progress is still meditation and all kinds of other things to kind of calm the monkey mind, but and then work on sleep quality. But as far as physically, it's incredible. But at 51 years old, the BPC-157 just helps when I get kind of flare ups with with joint pain so I can keep moving. And then that ultimately addresses the joint pain.
Yeah. I mean, they're never, I don't see them ever being like, oh yeah, you can just go get BPC. Can you imagine if we could just go get BPC 157 at an orthopedist office instead of getting our bodies cut open, you know? But unfortunately, I could go into an orthopedics office and get surgery approvals, but I couldn't get anything approved for what I needed to treat Lyme disease. So it was just, it was such a comedy of errors, especially pre-2020 that I went through. So like, I feel like talking now, especially men's hormone levels, because that's something that I feel like men are a little bit like shameful to talk about, like low testosterone and everything. So knowing that there's like peptides out there that you can try to access that before you go on HRT or something like that. I think what you said is right. I think that if we regulate ourselves and get our machine adjusted the way that we need to, that we can regulate anything within our own system. And it doesn't really matter what age we are at. And I know that's true because I've gotten rid of everything that they said I couldn't get rid of. So I'm just not a very valuable human right now in that world.
Well, I've always said this too, and it is a conspiracy because we know the mentality of some of these people in the healthcare world, like the Sacklers behind Purdue Pharma, for example, with OxyContin. There are some horrible people, you know, who ultimately are broken people that if they just did their own healing would probably become very altruistic and want to make the world better. But that being said, right now, they're preying upon the weak, and there's no money in dead people and there's no money in healthy people. But you have an
there's so much money in healthy people, though, you know, because I'm going to buy all the blood tests. I'm going to, like, longevity is a huge industry, and there's actually so much money in the psychedelic industry. I think they said it was slated to be an $11.8 billion industry by 2029. So hopefully, knowing how our politicians operate, it can be on the backs of that we actually get some healing for people, because we have been grossly sold out by our legislators, and we have been kept from, you know, our full potential as human beings and picked off, frankly. And they owe a huge debt to us. And, you know, I think the American people are tired of the abuse that we've been suffering at their hands. And if they don't watch it, I mean, we might get our pitchforks out. Because I'm ready to do that if they don't make some change here.
I've said the same thing. Torches and pitchforks. Just, I mean, basically, you know,
let's go.
If we keep getting the same kind of person every 4 years, and the perfect example is the obesity crisis. That's either side of the aisle for decades. And yet, and then during COVID, we were told that it was for the health of the people, that we had to have vaccines and masks. But neither side has done anything to make Americans healthier, apart from removing red dye. Wow, that's fucking groundbreaking. Congratulations. You know what I mean? Yeah. So you just have to open your eyes and realize that the American people are suffering so that a few people make a lot of money. But going back to what you said, though, that is a very good point. The preventative side, there is money to be made. And I think people will gladly pay. Yeah, I'd love to know my blood panel and regulate my hormones and, you know, make sure that my nutritional panel is correct and, you know, that there aren't any risk factors for my cardiovascular and all the other areas. I think that's where money would be absolutely well spent. So it's a great point that you make. There is money. Yeah, the industry doesn't have to collapse. We just got to go into the preventative side and then the clean nutrition and support local farmers with organic food and support local gyms and rucking communities. And all of a sudden we would have an incredibly healthy nation. And then lo and behold, there'd be a lot of money then for education, all the other things that we got to pour into.
It just has to shift, you know, that's all it has to do. And we have to be given the choices, you know. It's fine. Like, if you want to like go through the McDonald's drive through every day, like that is available to you, you know, but like we should also be able to, you know, inject ourselves with peptides as an alternative to getting cut open by an orthopedist. And we should be able to see if our bodies can do it on our own. And we should be able to choose that option for our medical care. So yeah. Thanks, RFK, for removing red dye. But what else you got, brother? Because, I mean, it's a tall hill and they're at the bottom. So they're going to have to make some more moves. And, you know, at this point, I mean, like, we are at their mercy. And I don't know if anything even matters anymore. But Access matters, and medical access matters. And when I go down to Tijuana, Mexico, and I see that the government there is promoting and churning out better medical care than we are in the United States, that's sad to me, you know?
Yeah.
That's, I mean, in Tijuana, like their nursing staff, their like their medical care is, their government pays for it. They're given these jobs. They're hardworking people. And I would trust them over most American medical facilities at this point. And that's a sad sentence to have to say, but it's also like, no one should be worried about going to Tijuana, Mexico for medical care either. I know that we've done a great job in the United States to make sure that we've tainted every American from believing that any outside source could help them. But I'm here to tell you, you know, we're only removing red dye. Well, so there's that.
I come from a country that had national health. And back when I was young, it was still supported. So it was a real national health. And you think about it, if you have a tax-based healthcare system, then the incentive is to make people healthy. So you don't dip into the tax very much. You have a profit-based healthcare system, which we have, or disease management system is a better word for it. Then the incentive is to create people that are sick. I mean, it's just pure basic. No one can say it's conspiracy. It's economics. So yeah. Which one do you want? Do you want one that you don't have to worry about losing your home when you have the audacity to get cancer or hit by a bus? Or do you want to have the one that they kind of trick you into, oh, it's only this copay, but it's not. It's, you know, it's costing this country trillions of dollars, you know, which could be a con to everything.
We live on Band-Aids in this country. You know, we sell a lot of Band-Aids here, and everybody's just walking around with gaping sores. So something's got to shift. Something's got to change. It is survival of the fittest, you know, and I do feel like, you know, the people that are trying to figure it out for everybody are doing a great job at also not gatekeeping it and getting the word out. But it needs to be something that is available to everybody. And working with the first responder community, like I'll be in an Ibogaine clinic and everybody there is like suffering from whatever they're going through, suicidal ideations. And then, oh, guess what else? They're having a hard marriage over all of this. Oh, and then guess what else? Now they're in debt because they had to go get help. And then that is just all compounding on top of it. And the fact of the matter is that substances like Ibogaine are available to, you know, the elite and privileged at this point in life. And we need to, you know, the American healthcare system needs to work to change that so that we can be provided for, not even just America, like all countries should do that. But I just happen to live in this one. So I have to work within the walls that I'm trapped. Mine is the American Healthcare Society. So we have to try to do better. And yeah, but if you go to the hospital, let's say the day that a tree fell on my family and we got a lot of bills that day. And you know, for me, I got a bunch of bills and I refused treatment. I pulled everything off and said no. But I still got bills for like hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, and they didn't even do anything for me. And my husband died, but I had all these bills. So for $10,000, soup to nuts, I can transform a first responder's life for the most part, or give them a gateway to do that. Not me personally, but just give them access. And then give them a supportive container for 1 year to implement their new life, you know, feeling like they want to live instead of wanting to die. And no hospital in America can do that.
You mentioned the tragedy. So talk to me about June 17th, 2022. And then how did that ultimately sprout the nonprofit that you've created?
June 17th, 2022, I was 6 weeks post my first ayahuasca journey, actually. I had used ayahuasca for my Lyme disease healing. when I tell people that I went to psychedelics for healing, there, you know, some people are like, oh my God. But let me tell you, like, I was dying. So it was that either I try psychedelics or I'm going to die. So how I'm going to die, it's either like heart attack or by my own hand. I don't know, but it was going to be something. So that's where I'm at when I'm going to sit with ayahuasca. And I took way too much ayahuasca. I had 155 milliliters of ayahuasca, and like a standard dose is like 75 mls. I would never take 75 mls now. If I journey with ayahuasca, I take about 30, and then I'll do another 10 after that wears off. But I don't like to go hardcore. So 30 is my standard dose. And this time I took 155. When you take that much ayahuasca, you go deep. So I went really deep, and my entire ayahuasca journey was about my husband and unconditional love. Not the entire journey, but a huge part of it. And it wasn't until that journey, and I'd been with him for almost 20 years at that point, that I actually believed that he loved me. So how a plant could connect me to unconditional love, I don't know, but ayahuasca did. And I don't know if you're a person that's ever experienced unconditional love. It's my goal in my life just to like use that. I use it as my fire now. But if you're a person that's experienced that, it doesn't matter if you've lost it, because I experienced unconditional love from my husband, and he was at a firehouse in New York City, and I was on a mountain side in Jersey with some dude named Jason and 30 other people. And and I had this like life changing, profound experience. And I learned a lot of other stuff that day too, that probably only people that drink ayahuasca would understand. So I'm not going to go through it on this podcast, but it allowed me to understand then the rest of the journey that I learned when my husband passed at 3:43 p.m. on June 17th, 2022. We were pulling onto the Biltmore estate, and we were in their driveway, and a tree fell. It gave way just at exactly the time that my family was driving under, and our 10-year-old at the time was hospitalized with four broken bones in his neck and back. And our oldest son, who's 19 at the time, was knocked out. And I had been hit in the head with a tree. My entire seat was crushed, and there wasn't anything wrong with me. My husband was dying in the seat next to me. And I learned I'm a terrible witness, and the story that I have in my mind about what happened after that isn't the story that happened. And I know that because I have a video of everything that happened. I was recording when we were going in because I was going to make a reel for my husband. So the video, there's a whole other series of events going on, including like my conversation with my husband and the songs that were playing. And in my mind, I had a completely different experience, including third person syndrome when my husband was dying. And the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do in my life was walk away from him when he was dying to go get in the ambulance with our youngest son.
How did you, or let me rephrase the question. You've done a psychedelic journey just prior to this. You have this devastating tragedy after having this realization of unconditional love. What part, if any, did sequential psychedelic journeys factor into processing the grief of such a tragedy?
I was super aware of like what my body was trying to do to help me. I think just because I'd become more body aware through breathwork practice, meditation, psychedelics. So I was like really like honoring what my body was trying to do and trying to help it do what it needed to do. So part of that was like, they say when animals get hit or like they have, they're attacked or whatever, that you'll see them after and they're oftentimes just shaking. because they're shaking off fear. And we're animals also. So I found that my body was just shaking so much. I knew I was in shock after it happened. I was really aware of that. But I also knew I had it. Like, I knew I didn't need barbiturates. I knew I didn't need, you know, anything to help me sleep. And I knew I didn't want that. I knew I didn't need alcohol. But I knew I needed to, like, eat and get a smoothie in me, like, even if I couldn't chew food. Because I couldn't. If anybody ever goes through anything like that, like, I mean, if you can eat a sandwich after that, I don't know. But I can't. So I just, like, knew I needed, like, protein. I needed my brain. I needed to figure out how to get a body back to New York. I need to figure out how to feed my dogs. I need to figure out, like, how to pay bills, how to live my whole life, like, how to be this person that I didn't want to be, you know? So how to be a single mom. Yeah, like, how to live without my right arm. So when something like this happens to you, it's not like, oh, you just lose that one person, you know? Like, I lost, like, everything that day. All the plans I had for my future, like, my whole identity. Like, I didn't, and nobody wanted it, you know? It's like, I wasn't Casey Scooten's wife, you know, anymore. And I loved that role for a long time. So part of, like, just that was just accepting that, you know, like, there's just this clinging that happens after you watch your best friend die, you know? And it still happens to me today. It's really triggering too, because you'll get into, like, a new situation or whatever. Just like even going to the grocery store, I never had to do that when Casey was alive. But, like, you get into that, and you're just, you know, you're triggered by everything, but you're evolving into this other role. And for me, since I had sat with psychedelics and notably, like, the hardest psychedelics on the planet. I don't know what that means. But, you know, I sat with these psychedelics, and I had this other knowing that this energy of my husband, this energy of this unconditional love, it existed, you know, no matter if his flesh vessel was operating or not. And I knew what to do. I knew immediately that I was going to use his life insurance policy to build this organization. I knew that he was going to keep saving lives. I knew that it was going to be called the 343 Fund. And then if I tried to get off of my journey or my path, or, like, talk myself into a different, like, way, or just not completing the mission that I knew I had to do, everything just rerouted me towards the way that I needed to go. So, yeah, we've sent 130 first responders, 54% have been active duty, 54% have been police officers, and I think, like, 5% have been EMTs, and then the rest firefighters. And I get to hear people tell me that we saved their life, and I get to hear their kids tell me, thanks for giving me my dad back, and I get to hear people tell me I went to 7 different inpatient alcohol rehabs and nothing worked, but I've been sober for 10 months. And I get to hear people tell me that they don't have their TBI symptoms anymore, and that they're sleeping every night without their CPAP machine, and that they don't have physical pain in their body anymore, phantom pain. Yeah, and I get to sleep every night, including the night that my husband died and I walked away from his body and our son was in a hospital bed and I didn't know what I was doing or how I was getting anybody back to New York or doing a funeral, but I knew my body needed sleep. And I knew it was the power of psychedelics that gave me the ability to tell my mind to be quiet and give my body the rest that it needed. Yeah, and I've not used any of my old tools, alcohol or Xanax or Adderall or cocaine or anything that I used to love to use. But I've also stopped shaming myself from everything that I used to exist and started looking at all of the substances as just really good teachers, and also gratitude for them. Gratitude that if there wasn't for alcohol, I don't even know if anybody in my family would have made it. Real talk, you know? It took a lot of alcohol to drown the sorrows, but yeah. And I feel like, yeah, gratitude that alcohol was there and that cocaine was there and that Adderall was there, because I built a lot with all of those substances and they kept me here until I could find tools like breathwork to regulate my central nervous system and ways to want to be in my body. So yeah, I'm super grateful for my psychedelic journeys. They were great guides for my role in life now. And without them, I don't know. I don't know if I would even be here, to be honest with you. But I am here, and a lot of people get triggered by the way that I kept myself here, you know? But I see a lot of people keep themselves here the same way and have really healthy lives, free of SSRIs and mood stabilizers and Suboxone and alcohol and Kratom and Adderall and all of the things, the tools that aren't so good for your immune system. So yeah, I did all of that stuff, and I had Lyme disease probably since I was 11 years old. And I just had a straw that broke the camel's back. It happened to be working out 7 days a week, which is a straw for breaking my camel's back. So it looked like a really healthy straw, but like underneath that was like misuse of alcohol, Adderall addiction, and, you know, expensive food that wasn't doing anything because of all the other stuff I was doing. So, yeah.
You mentioned how you were reminiscing with your daughter. Was that right?
My son.
It was your son, sorry. About, you know, pre-tragedy and where you were now. I think one of the areas that seems so under-discussed, and this could be just through, you know, mental health counseling, it could be through, a psychedelic journey, it could be a mental health, you know, trauma element, it could be grief, but we don't hear enough about post-traumatic growth, about the hope of who the person is on the other side. It sounded like you were talking fondly about where you are today. So talk to me about that. You were reflecting on, you know, obviously this beautiful marriage, you know, being a firefighter spouse and, you know, all the other elements that you had pre-2022. Where are you now? And what would you say for people that maybe didn't think there was any hope, that there wasn't kind of light at the end of that work tunnel, if you like?
Well, it's hard to answer that question because I'm in a really, really good place today, which also comes with a tremendous amount of guilt underlying. You know, I'm in a really good place because my husband sacrificed his life, you know, and every time I was sitting at a kitchen table with a group of first responders, two police officers and two firefighters, and I said to them, I know Casey would want to have saved each of your lives. And I get to look around the table and know that, like, my husband doesn't exist, but this guy sitting across from me does, you know. And one guy I was working with, he actually had trauma from a riot. And he had a traumatic brain injury, and he'd been taken away from his family. So to know that my husband's life is been given in exchange for giving this man, you know, his life back, where he's still here living with his kids and his wife. There's really no greater feeling in the world than doing the work that I do. And if my husband hadn't died, I wouldn't get to do this. And so the reason why I'm so happy is because of service to others that has been allowed from the death and perceived loss of unconditional love. But I get to transmute unconditional love every day and save people's lives. So I feel an immense amount of gratitude for my journey and my path. And I say Lyme disease was one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given in my life. And the death of my husband is probably the second greatest gift I've ever been given.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, like you talk about the guilt and the shame on a surface level, you know, that kind of makes sense. But I mean, when you were talking, how often do you hear, you know, a parent who's lost a child say, God, if I could just have gone in their place? You know, this was, as you said, this was something that Casey was able to make that sacrifice, you know, voluntary, involuntary, whatever the grand scale of the universe is. And now this legacy is living on, and his two beautiful sons are, you know, are thriving now. And then you've got this nonprofit, and the ripple effect is helping all these other people and their wives and then husbands and children. So it is. I mean, you know, there's no room for guilt and shame, because, you know, we can't undo these tragedies, but it's what you do with that after, you know, with that person that you adored so much. Want you curled up in the corner of a room with a scotch bottle, or would they want you out there doing exactly what you're doing today?
Yeah, I think about that part that we were talking about, that being stuck, or like accepting your, like that, okay, I'm going to be sick for the rest of my life. Accepting that identity. That happens too when you're a widow, and you can pick, like, do I want this widow identity to attach itself to me? Like, and when everybody in town looks at me, you know, they're like, oh, that's the lady that lost her husband really young. And that could be my story, or, you know, for the rest of my life. And I could attach myself to that, and nobody would feel bad about that. They would accept that. But that is not a story that I want to attach myself to. And it's also not the story that Casey Scudin wants, you know, not only for his legacy, but, you know, for his family. So yeah, my kids have said, my oldest actually said after Casey passed, he said, Mom, you know, it's so hard to lose dad, but I can't imagine if I'd lost you. And I know that Casey feels the same way. Like, I know that my boy's life would be so different if it had been the other way around. And I know that I have a job to do that Casey left in my hands, and he knows that I can do it. And he knows, you know, that I know what he wants for our boys and for him. And I'm going to continue to do that, you know, for the rest of my days. So even though, you know, I'll do it as Angela Scudin and not Mrs. Casey Scudin.
Well, I'm sure people listening either want to help, contribute, or maybe even be a recipient of it. How do they find the Casey Scudin 343 fund?
We're a 501c3, so all donations are tax deductible. And you can find it by looking up the 343fund.org. There's a link for a grant application, and you can click a link for a tax deductible donation.
Beautiful. Well, before we get to where everyone can find, you know, you as well, there's some closing questions I'd love to throw at you if you've got time.
Sure.
Okay. All right. The first one is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Oh my God, this is such a funny question. So I've never read a book in my entire life. I have a lot of books, but I've read parts of a book. And yeah, to answer your question, Daniel Brett wrote a book called Iboga. And it's a really good educational readable book regarding that. And yeah, that would be the only book I would recommend. And I listen to a lot of Alan Watts, though. So I'm a big listener.
He was amazing. It's a shame. There's a lot of people in history I wish I could have got on the podcast, you know, but the timing was just wrong.
Yeah, you could still listen to Alan Watts, though. He can get in your head.
Absolutely. All right. Well, what about films and documentaries?
There's actually a really good documentary right now called Waves in War. Marcus Capone, you mentioned him earlier. He's actually in that documentary. And it actually shows like him going down to Ambio and Tijuana, Mexico. And so you can get kind of like a view of what psychedelics have been doing for special operators. But also you can keep in mind that everybody deserves to be free. So psychedelics are for everyone. And then there's also the documentary that changed my life, the HEAL documentary. I think that's an important documentary. It has nothing to do with psychedelics, but it does have to do with your human body and your mind and the power of that to heal.
Brilliant. All right. Well, speaking of great people, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Yeah, I would recommend Aaron Suzo. So he's actually been on a few podcasts, and he's actually gone down to Ambio and experienced this himself. He was a SWAT or gang unit officer in Hayward, and you know, has a pretty compelling story. So he'd be a good one for you to talk to from the law enforcement perspective and what it actually is like going down to Tijuana, Mexico to get help for yourself.
Brilliant. Yeah, I would love to get him on maybe after he's had some time to process what he's gone through.
Yeah, he went last September, so he'd probably be amped to talk to you.
Okay. So. Yeah, if you help able to make that connection, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you. All right. Well, the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you, what do you do to decompress?
I do breath work. Like my favorite thing is box breathing. So I used to be I live in New York. I love driving in New York. It's like Mario Kart, but I also like to keep my chill. So sometimes like just a little box breathing regulates your central nervous system in less than 30 seconds. So yeah, a little four count in, hold, four count out, hold is my favorite.
Fantastic. All right. Well, you mentioned where to find the 343 fund. Are there any other places, social media, et cetera, people can find you?
Yeah, you can find me on social media. yeah, I'm at Rock Center Pockets or Angela Scudin. And the 343 fund is on Instagram and Facebook. And the best way to get a hold of me would probably be via a DM on Instagram. So
beautiful. Well, I want to thank you so much. Thank you to Michael again for yet another amazing connection, amazing story, but also to you, and not just for what you're doing now, but as I underline often, you know, when people are revisiting some of the harder parts of their life story, you know, I understand that at that moment it's taken a toll. You're kind of reopening that wound, but I know that so many people listening are going to really, it's going to resonate with them, and it's going to then have a ripple effect in their lives as well. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and courageous and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, James. I appreciate it.